You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hi, and welcome to The Compass, the podcast documenting the struggles of life as an artist. I'm Leah Walsh.
Hi, everyone. So my guest today is Ryan Spahn. Ryan is an actor, writer, and producer who we pretty much met because of Juilliard. I'm trying to remember back to when we first met for the very first time. But he went to Juilliard a few years after I graduated. We did not overlap there. We might have met first through his partner, Michael Urie, who's also a Juilliard grad. But we've kept in touch since he got out of school. And I just really enjoy his company and admire the way he always has several different projects going, whether it's writing his new screenplay or play or his acting projects. So I was delighted when he came over last week to have this conversation, but first he came to meet the baby and we had dinner with Frankie, and then we recorded the podcast at the end of the night, which was definitely past both of our bedtimes. So you might catch us a little bit on the loopy side in this conversation. Thank you so much for sharing with me, Ryan, and I hope you all enjoy the 135th episode of The Compass. What do you do to try to keep from going to the dark side as an artist?
I don't know if I have successfully figured that out. Being in my relationship has really helped, and it has helped me to try to pinpoint what it is about being an artist that causes me sometimes to go to a dark place. And I think often, sometimes I wonder if I was in any field, would that still happen?
Right.
Because I think there's something about, at least the way I'm chemically made, that I'm prone to certain dark thoughts or dark feelings or dark reactions to things. And so as I've gotten older, I've tried really hard to be kinder to myself and try to understand what it is about my brain or the way I feel or react to something that is causing me to feel a certain way, and divorcing it from being a result of being an artist, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Because I think, like, something that recently I've been thinking a lot about is that I don't struggle with jealousy in the traditional sense, or comparing myself to others in the traditional sense. I struggle the most with something that I've thought about a lot recently, is that I set markers that are kind of irrational.
As like where you should be.
Yeah, like something as simple as like, if I was nominated for a theater award, maybe then I could have an audition for the Roundabout. Oh, this is theater award season. I didn't get nominated for anything. I will have another year before I have an opportunity to audition for the Roundabout. These are the things that I think about in a way that is not helpful and lives under, I think, the category of comparing and jealousy. But I think it's more about me placing markers that are just irrational. Does that make sense?
Yeah, because it's really nothing that has anything to do with the work you're doing. Like, you can't go into a rehearsal process being like, my objective is to get an award.
Sure, that was just an example. That's not actually, but things that are like that, that's like, it's not about, there's like a result that I have placed on something that, like, if X happens, then XXX will happen, which isn't the way it works and isn't true necessarily. And I think that that is something that I have spent a lot of time thinking about. So in answer to the actual bigger question of how do I not go to the dark place, is I try really hard to figure out what would spiral me down and try to figure out exactly what I'm doing to cause myself to let me take that step that sends me to a dark place and try to refrain from making that step.
And do you feel like you've had some success in just like the awareness?
Yeah.
Able to like pause and move in a different direction when you have those thoughts?
I'm literally been trying to reprogram my emotional reaction to things and how I internalize them, I guess.
That's awesome that you're at the point where you're aware of it.
I do. Yeah,
because sometimes it's hard to even articulate what you're doing.
Yeah. And we were talking about this earlier about how, you know, I personally have struggles with depression, and I have been aware of the fact that I sometimes like to wallow in that, and I feel very comfortable in that. And I think that that is just not helpful at all, especially in the field that we're in.
Right.
You know.
I've dealt with that a little bit, and I feel like it almost gets to a point where you feel like you're doing something.
Like, oh, at least it's active
somehow.
Yeah.
Sure. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, because it's deeply introspective, depression can be. So you're like psychoanalyzing everything. So there's something about that that is super active and is very stimulating, because you're really like unpacking a lot of deep, 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 deep thoughts that I don't know if we necessarily need to, if they're not actually a part of our day-to-day life. There's this great play that I did in school. We both went to Juilliard. Mm-hmm. For those of you who don't know who we are. But my final year of school, it was a play by Amy Herzog named The Great God Pan. And it's a play about a guy in scene. It's like, I think like 6 or 8 two-person scenes, more or less. And in the first scene, it's 2 old friends who were never really friends beyond the elementary school years. And one is very conservative, and one has gone sort of like more eccentric and like funky, and they just are like oil and water when you meet them. Mm-hmm. And the one that's gotten less conservative is like, dude, I just want you to know, when we were younger, my dad molested me, and I'm pretty sure he molested you. Will you stand in court with me and testify? And the more conservative guy is like, I don't know what you're talking about, and that didn't happen. And so then the next series of scenes is you watching this guy, the conservative guy, who he clearly was. Hmm. And you see the patterns of it in all of his relationships. So then you're wondering, is he better to have not known that information? Or is he better to have known it?
Right.
And so sometimes I think when we spiral too deep into our thoughts, I have found that it's like, I don't know if I need to know this. I don't know if I need to be thinking about this as deeply as I'm thinking about it.
I wonder if it's one of those things kind of like we go through an acting training where it's about like analyzing so much and going so deep into it so you can eventually throw it away.
Oh yeah, good luck throwing it away.
But then how do you throw it away when you're really dealing with like your shit?
Yeah, I don't know. And you know, at least if you're lucky enough to be an actor as your full-time job, 60% or more of the year is spent sitting alone at home.
Right.
You know? And so your mind just is left to create a lot.
Yeah.
And so I've also, like, practically, I started becoming a writer. So I write a lot. And I started in my early 20s writing pretty regularly. And that has helped me keep me out of my head. Or I have learned from other people to really set up a really full week socially, to get me out of my house, to get me around people, signing up for, you know, the 52nd Street Project or things like that, where you can get yourself among other people who are probably struggling with the same thing you are, and just you're not talking about it. And then you end up in an environment where you can totally focus all your energy on something outside of yourself.
Yeah. So how did you first get into writing?
First got into writing because I read a Julia Cameron book called The Artist's Way.
That's right. I honestly forgot in that moment that you had mentioned that
because you have
to
it
me
on,
earlier.
You
yeah,
have it on your bookshelf.
He saw it on my bookshelf and said, but luckily, since having a baby, I have no memory, and so I completely forgot that you.
My
told
name
me
is
that.
Ryan.
Ryan.
I.
But how did you find it? How did you just...
I'm trying to remember who told me to look at it.
Because the early 20s, you had gone to, quick history of Ryan, you had gone to Interlochen Arts Academy for high school.
Correct.
And then not undergrad, you just moved to LA.
Yeah, when I was 17, I moved from Interlochen. I went back to Detroit, which is where that area is where I'm from. And mm-hmm. then I moved like months later. I drove cross country, moved to LA and lived there till I was 27.
Right. And then eventually you went to Juilliard when you were
29 much later. Is when I started. Yeah. Yeah.
So when you started writing,
mm-hmm.
yeah, what brought it all around?
I feel like it was my friendship with Kristen Hange, who was a director in the city, but we were living in LA at the time. And I feel like she told me about it. But I initially started writing. The first thing I ever wrote with anyone was a little bit pre that book. And it was because I had met this person named Salome Malagueta. She's Ethiopian. She wanted to be a movie star and wanted to start a movie and create a movie. We both had no idea what we were doing. We met through a mutual friend and we just started writing together. And then I would read screenwriting books. And then I joined a screenwriting class in Santa Monica. And then Kristen started helping us with like the structure of it, because she actually went to college for screenwriting. And during that process, I opened Julia Cameron's book. And then that got me like actively writing and understanding like why I want to do it, aside from like the practical side of it, like making it actually work, why I wanted to write myself.
Has it always taken the form of scripts?
It was like screenplays for a while, and then I wrote those for probably like 7 or 8 years. And then during my time at Interlochen, the three that I had written and had spent a lot of years trying to get made all got made every break during my time at school, which was bizarre the way that that worked out. So like I'm in my training at college and then prepping these movies during the workload that you know we all have.
During the busiest time of
During the busiest time of my life, I'm like also sending emails about like budgets and, you know, casting and...
I feel like that time could really fuel you though, because you're already like running on 10 cylinders or whatever. It's
yeah.
like you just have to keep going.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean,
it's a weird adrenaline.
I'm so much better at everything when I have everything happening at the same time.
Right. Exactly.
If one thing is driving my life, it's going to just fall apart. Not really, but like, you know, but it's the same thing. Like say an audition, if you obsess on it, it's just going to like, you're going to freak out in the room. But if you have right. like many things happening, it might just accidentally go fantastic. Right?
Now that is usually how it works out.
Yeah.
But then we're supposed to somehow make it a science so we can recreate that every time.
Right.
I was telling you before, I need to revisit The Artist's Way. That's awesome that it really worked for you to like kickstart something.
It just worked because I say this and no judgment to the book, I didn't feel like the book was actually a challenging piece of material to work on. It just was like what I needed at that moment.
Right. It just created a practice
and
for
it
you.
Created a practice and also gave me permission to be validated that I'm capable.
Right.
You know, that you don't have to have somebody give you permission to do this.
What did your family think of you moving to LA?
When I was 14, I called Juilliard and was like, I'm going to go to your school one day, which is bizarre because I had read that like Robin Williams went there, and they said that I should go to Interlochen for art school. That's how I found Interlochen. And so I
wow.
ended up going to Interlochen for 3 years. And so by that point, when I was told my parents I was going to LA, I had been out of the house for 3 years already living okay. at this boarding school. So they sort of were like, great. Cause that, you know, I don't know deeply what they thought. I'm sure there was a lot of fear, but there's probably a lot of pride too. Cause I had done this whole boarding school experience. completely on my own. Like, they didn't pay for it. I worked a lot of jobs, fundraised, did things like that to pay for school.
Right. And no one else in your family is creatively minded?
My mom was, when she was younger. She was in one of the original tours of the Fantastics.
Really?
Playing the female character. She was the understudy, and then that person broke their leg accidentally, quote unquote. And she took over the role. And then she stopped to raise a family, and was not to raise a family. She's just like, I don't want this lifestyle. I want to be a mother. And so she stopped and then had kids and raised a family. And so she sang a lot in the church choir, and, you know, still to this day walks around speaking in accents. Which is really not annoying at all. It's
do they get a chance to see a lot of your work?
Yeah, they have.
Since you left home?
My parents are divorced and now remarried, and or not now, but they've been remarried for like 20 years. The two couples will come to try to see stuff. My dad and my stepmom tend to come more just because they love coming to New York. Mm. And my mom and my stepfather, my mom comes by herself. My stepfather isn't a big traveler, so he actually hasn't seen a lot. But I also do a lot of plays where I'm in peril as a character, like either a gun is in my face or I'm dying on stage, or pretty consistently. And so my mom has gotten to the point where she's like, I need to know if this is one of those plays, because I don't know if I can do it again.
That is unbelievably sweet.
It is. And also, like, it's not about you, Mom. Come see my play.
It's all make-believe. I remember in undergrad, we did Othello, and I played Desdemona and a bunch
of... Othello?
Othello. Othello. And a bunch of my... like close friends from high school came down whose parents were like my parents growing up. And one of my friend's dads afterwards was like, if he had held that pillow over your face 5 more seconds, I was going to run on stage and pull it out. I was like, oh, so sweet.
That's very sweet.
Very sweet. I'm glad it didn't happen. But very, very sweet.
I'm kind of wish it did. That would have been like its own play.
It's going to save me. So what did you think about LA? Do you ever think about what role does, location play for you now? Do you ever think about moving back to LA? Are you feeling pretty attached to New York?
I'm definitely feeling attached to New York. LA,
since you have the unusual experience of really, really having lived in both places.
I have deep, deep friendship with deep friendships with certain people and who currently live in Los Angeles. So there's that side of it that that I miss. So, you know, 2 weeks ago or last week, we were in LA for like 10 days and I was busy all day long seeing all these people I hadn't seen in a long time. So I love LA when there's a date where I'm leaving it.
Right.
I have no interest in living there just to live there. I think I would enjoy it if I had a job that was keeping me there, again, where it had like an end date and then I could leave it. I feel like LA feels like what a lot of people think hometown feels like, because I don't have that feeling about Michigan, because I was until 8th grade, and then I went to this boarding school, and so my hometown experience is sort of all over the place. And then when I moved to LA, being there at 17 and sort of having my college experience be real life experience, that feels like going back home. And so when I go to LA, I get that sort of anxiety of, ugh, I just need to get out of hometown.
Been here long enough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like every street has a memory. I was there before smartphones, so I learned my way around by like a Thomas guide, which is this old map that was 7,000 pages long. So now when I go back, I know the city so well. I can drive everywhere without much thought. And so there's something about that that's really nice. I just love New York. I just love New York. I really do.
Can we talk about why you decided to go back to school and to go to Juilliard in your late 20s? Mm-hmm. Or like what it was about your life in LA leading up to that that led to that decision?
So when I was about 25 or 26, I was in LA, and I was at that point I was a waiter, but I was had a really active commercial acting life. So mm-hmm. I actually was making a lot of money being a commercial actor, but I couldn't quit my job for whatever reason, because the money was so good also waiting tables, and I only worked 15 hours a week. And then I just had this like moment where I saw this being my life until I'm 50. And I started then putting myself up for regional theater jobs and like really like actively pursuing getting out of LA and like doing theater, because I was doing a lot of theater in LA, which was wonderful and amazing for me, but no one goes to see it.
Is it mostly, it's like small storefront theaters out there, except for the
couple large... similar to like Chicago storefront theater, but the community is so great. Anyone who's into theater who moves to LA will have a rewarding theater experience if they want it. It's completely insular, unlike in New York, which is a shame. Anyway, so then I started doing regional theater, and then that made me realize I don't want to be living in LA anymore. I want to move to New York. I quit my waiting tables job. I moved to New York. And then I started to try to get into the New York theater scene, which is hard to do. It's really hard to crack that. And I would go on these... I would go on like the Equity open calls. I would go online and like find all the like castings that are listed and like look at all the names and just start Googling those names and finding emails and being like, hey, I'm this person. I just moved.
What you're supposed to do.
Which is supposed to do. And, and it's how I worked. Like I got many jobs out of that when I first moved to New York. Some of them were really like well-paid jobs, and it was because I was aggressively hunting for it. But then I would also get recommended for things, which is at once a great thing, but it's also a dangerous thing, because if the people don't know you, they might be only taking the recommendation as a favor. Mm-hmm. And because of that, I had entered a period of time where I was going to these rooms where I was a lot of favors, and I didn't know that. And the feeling from the other side of the table when you are the favor of somebody else is there's nothing worse than that. It's so upsetting. It's like that moment when you're in a relationship and you realize, oh, this person is not as in love with me as I am with them, and like they lied to me. That feeling, it lives somewhere in there. And I went home one day and was so upset. And Michael, who's my partner, he didn't know what to do. And so he filled out my application to Juilliard, which is how I ended up at Juilliard. The next morning I woke up and he's like, listen, I don't know how to help you. I don't know what to say, but this school changed my life. So you should audition.
So you didn't audition anywhere else?
Mm-mm. I did my essays, and then I showed up, and I was actually in a play during the auditions, and I didn't know that I didn't know how it worked, because I honestly didn't like read much about it. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize that you auditioned, and then if you got called back, you had to stay the rest of the day. But I had a show at 8 that night, so I had to pull them all aside and was like, I gotta go, like I can't finish this. I hadn't done my interview. They like bumped up my like monologue presentation thing that you do at your callback. There's something you do where you like go in one, you like redo the monologue. And then I went and did my play. And then like a week later, I had to come back in and do an interview. And then we had the callback weekend. And then I ended up going to Juilliard.
What a life change.
Crazy life change.
At that point in your life. Like, because I went right after undergrad, so I was kind of still in that school mode.
You know? You were like 22 or 23-ish or
21? Yeah, 22.
Yeah, I was 20. I was 29 when I got in. I think by the time school began, I had just turned 30.
Yeah. But how was that to kind of go from no structure to all structure all the time?
Well, I was desperate for structure.
That's what you wanted.
I think that I didn't know that that's what I wanted, but right. I realized I did want this. I wanted someone to check me in. I wanted somebody to care that I was there. I had had like a decade of, while I was living off of what I was doing, it was, I mean, I'd said earlier about like, if you're lucky, you're like 60% of your day is free or whatever. I was working like 3 days a year.
Right. With commercials.
With commercials, but making enough to like survive. And it was like, and then I was doing these plays that no one was seeing. It was just like, it was, it was a lot. So when I went to school and it was like nine to 11 every day and
really getting to dive into what you love.
Yeah. And my partner had gone there, and so he knew what I was going through. So it made, like, our relationship nothing. But remarkably, it was never challenged during that time because we also had the luxury of living very close to campus. So I never had that, like, hour-long commute before and after school. And because he was an alum, he could come to everything, so he could participate in the whole, like, experience of it.
Yeah.
In a way that I think a lot of couples can't survive a school situation because they don't have that connection.
Right. We don't have to talk about this if you don't want to, but how have you and Michael kind of dealt with the fact that you're both artists in your relationship over the years? So you're both actors.
We're both actors. It's been helpful because we're very different.
Right.
So that's helpful. If somebody wants him, they're most likely not going to want me, regardless of where we are in our careers.
Right. You're not going out for the same auditions.
Yeah. We might, just because unfortunately, if you're gay, you're all lumped into the same category and like,
right.
But if they want a Michael type, they're not going to go with a Ryan in most cases. So that's helped, but it's also been because his career is at a very different place than mine, we're just not ever on the same trajectory. And so it's been pretty easy. It's been easy because we both care so much about the other person's happiness. And like, we were recently up at Interlochen this past weekend revisiting my school, and we got to speak to the kids. And Michael did not go there, but we went together, and because he's been on television, I knew that they would be excited because they probably would recognize him. And so we spoke on a panel to all of the current students, and this conversation came up, which was remarkably poised for a 10th grader to wonder how a couple stays together when they're both in the field. And I'm like, you're in 10th grade, how dare you say field? Something he said that I found to be very true is that if the success of your partner doesn't give you tremendous joy, then something's wrong.
Yeah.
And I think that that is something that we never had to, and then when he said that, I was like, oh yeah, you're right. Like, we've been together almost 11 years and because if he has an explosion of something, I might have a feeling related to the field that we're in and wanting, like, you know, wanting certain things, but it's never about jealousy with him or comparing with him or any of those kinds of things. It's
right.
And I think part of it too is because one of my dear friends early on, when I was like 19 in LA, she was 19, I was like 20, she started to become very successful. And so I had to, at an early age, know how to handle that. I think that has helped actually preserve me in an older age in relationships with friends and loved ones who have varying levels of success, when it's very hard to not like spiral.
Right. Just keep your eyes on your own page.
There's that, but yeah, it's also just like, yeah, it's also like, you know, you got to follow the green lights that are in front of you. And those are not going to be the same for everyone else. And
right.
Also, something that's so true is like, if you didn't get it, if you didn't get the job or whatever, it's because it wasn't your job to have. Like, it just wasn't. You know, there's nothing you could have done to make that have changed. You know what I mean? Like, there's literally nothing. Which is hard to remember and hard to think about. And I think all of those things have helped us be a very healthy home. And we have a dog and a cat, and that helps. Yeah. We also talk and check in with each other almost excessively.
So I'm sure you've had to spend some big chunks of time apart.
We have, but that's also been good for us. Like, you know, a couple weeks off where we just are out of the home together. Like, we're not in the same building and we're like in different areas, different cities or something, but still communicating on a daily basis, but not like in each other's face, has been helpful for the pining aspect of relationships, right, which can kind of go stagnant if you're just staring at each other all day long.
So I know with your writing, and you were mentioning the films that you made during the summers at Juilliard, mm-hmm. like you have several people that you've collaborated with over and over again, mm-hmm. particularly your friend Haley.
Hallie. Sorry. It's okay. Hallie Pfeiffer.
I told you I was going to turn into a pumpkin. your friend Hallie. And that started before you went to Juilliard, right?
Hallie and I met at, I was doing a play in Martha's Vineyard, and she and her mother waited for me in the lobby after the show to introduce themselves, and Hallie and I became friends that way. And then we started, when I moved to New York, I sort of forced myself on her as a friend. I like wouldn't let it go, and we decided to write something together, and that's how our friendship began. And then when that movie was completed, we then like a year later made a web series together.
And what's your style of writing together? What does that look like?
Well, we haven't written together since then. Those were the two things we did together, because then she had always been a playwright and her plays started to get produced, and then that pulled her down the path of being staffed on television shows and being like pulled to Los Angeles and having a super successful playwriting career in addition to this television career. And she's also an actor. So mm-hmm. we stopped writing together. We worked together for about 3 years and then that stopped.
Okay.
Which I loved doing it. We both still talk about a day in which we'll do it again. But the process is, with other people I've collaborated with in addition to her, is you cannot be sensitive if someone doesn't like your idea. That's the thing I learned the quickest, is like, I may come in with a super strong idea and I think I'm like the smartest person ever, and I'll deliver that idea and she'll look at me like I've never, you know, done anything until smart in my life. And you can't be sensitive to that, because you have to be open to the fact that, like, I hear a baby.
Baby cries.
There's a baby in the house. You just have to be open to the smartest idea in the room when you're collaborating. And that is often not going to be yours.
Would you guys kind of go away and each work on something and then come back together?
We would never do that.
Or do you always, like,
we'd always sit.
Somebody's on the laptop, someone's just talking, and you're just figuring it out together.
We usually would sit side by side and try to make each other laugh. And then whatever, like, laughed is what went down. And then we often, the second time around, we actually sort of more plotted out what the episodes were going to be. When we were writing the film, this film is called He's Way More Famous Than You, and it's sort of a meta mockumentary. Mm-hmm. So we're sort of writing this, like, fictitious story in which we play brother and sister in the movie, and we're trying to get a movie made, which is actually what we're doing, and sort of the shenanigans that happen in doing that. And that was more just, we just would write as we went. We didn't plan anything out.
But it's a big thing. It's just you cannot be too sensitive if somebody critiques your idea when you're collaborating. You've got to be open to being wrong.
Letting it go.
Letting it go quickly and being wrong. Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about the self-producing aspect of this, all the work that you do?
Mm-hmm.
It just seems like such a big job. Like, how do you go about getting something off the ground?
Well,
finding those collaborators who are maybe either going to take that part of it off your plate or who are going to let you focus on the creative aspect.
It sort of lives in the same place as collaborating with your writers. You have to relinquish control and you have to reach out to people that you know do something better than you.
Mm-hmm.
So like, for instance, he's way more famous than you. We wrote the script. And then I had a friend in LA who had a film production company that I knew he had done a few things. And so I sent it to him to read and he responded to it. And then he was able to get the first like chunk of financing through his connection. So I don't know how he did that. But then for the next film, I had developed a relationship with those people. So I reached out to them around that guy, not without his permission. He just wasn't working on this project. I went to them directly. And so it's sort of like in the acting field, it's like most jobs you do are from people that know you or you worked on something with, which is why, again, you have to sort of go back to that following of the green lights, because the people you work with are the people who are going to work with you again. But if you're not working, even in any capacity, you're not meeting these people that may go on to be whatever to you later on that you're not aware of.
Right.
And I think that's true with filmmaking. You've got to always just talk about your project, show it to people, reach out, communicate, be open to just sending it to everyone, asking for help, set a date. Be like, June of 2020, we're going to start filming this, and just like drive towards that, because things just like come together. Like, it's sort of like what we said earlier about like keeping a lot of balls in the air and things just sort of land where they need to land. It's in the same place as that.
Are you ever in a place where you're, like we talked about the dark side earlier, where you're feeling like you don't want to put yourself out there anymore? You don't want to keep reaching out. You don't want to keep the balls.
Yeah,
there.
I mean, that's where I'm at.
To shut down.
That's where, I mean, we did these three, or, you know, I did them with different people, but I did three films, and then I did a web series, and then, yeah, I mean, the dark side of me will go down the path of like, and none of them got me a TV show.
Right, to the next level.
Yeah, no, I'm not, I didn't sell, like, you know, I sold a pilot idea to Warner Brothers, but it didn't sell to network, so then therefore it's done, and or like, I'm not the star of a TV show because of the film being up at, you know, in Park City. Like, there, you know, there's so many things that I can spiral on. And it's just, you have to actively not do it. Because there's no formula to, like, my career is now the last, you know, 10 or 15 years of things that I've done equal my career. But there is definitely not one thing that like catapulted me,
mm-hmm.
which I think is what a lot of people are looking for and hoping for, is this one definable thing and everything is post that.
Right.
And their lives changed. That's what people, I think, are hungry for, that lottery ticket thing, the lottery ticket element of this.
No, and that's what people applaud too.
Yeah. It's what people sit up to.
Yeah.
Totally. Yeah.
So you just have to make yourself keep reaching out and not
It sort of actually gets to what you touched on this quickly earlier, and we didn't talk about it, is like, what was it like to go to school later?
Mm-hmm.
And I remember something that was hard to swallow at Juilliard was when you're in your 30s and it's sort of related to what you just said of what people applaud. Teachers, a lot of them get into teaching because they want to see their work explode through a student right in front of them, and many of the younger students would have these giant leaps,
right?
And like like they're going through everything, and they were just like, they did things you didn't know they were capable of, and you're just blown away. And so much of that I had already gone through.
Right. They're starting from a different place.
Yeah. And so when my growth was more incremental for the most part, or like, you know, it was hard to put your finger on it. So I felt like sometimes the teachers weren't as interested in me. Hmm. Which is, I think, also the hard part of when you're a slow and steady, right. You know, middle class actor. You feel like no one's paying attention to you. Because you've never like popped in a way that makes everyone pay attention, and you can feel it. And then you're like, okay, this is that moment. Now this has happened. People are paying attention to me, and I can feel it. And
right.
That's never happened to me. And I can't be certain that it will ever happen. You know, it may never happen. It might just be this slow thing until I cease.
Which is pretty darn amazing, actually. Like, just even to be making your living as an artist, persisting and creating constantly. Like, that's...
Yeah, it is.
It's a pretty good creative life you have there.
It is, but it is for sure. But it is, it's definitely not enough. And you can, yeah. I can feel that pulsating through me, and I have to stop myself from letting it destroy me, because even the people that I know who have multi-million dollar films where they're being paid multi-millions of dollars to be in them have very similar feelings about the things that they aspire to beyond that.
Right. Which is interesting to, because we know people like that as well. And it's interesting to kind of know that it's never going to make you happier.
No, I think it's just a part of...
that's an easy thing to think.
Yeah. I think it's a part of your original question of how do you go from the dark side. I think it's like accepting that this is just a part of what we do. This sort of feeling is so a part of this field that you have to just accept it. You cannot fight it. Because if you fight it, I don't know if it... I think at the acceptance part of it, and the breathing through it, and the like realizing at any stage this is going to be a thing that pops up, for me has made it easier because of the people I know who are tremendously on paper more successful are talking about very similar things that I'm talking about when I have what I have.
Right.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com.
Are there any lessons you've learned in the last couple years that you're really proud of that you want to tell me about?
Well, one is definitely something I talked about earlier, which is the markers that I set for myself that I don't want to do that anymore. I definitely had a period when I got out of school where I had... because I'm like 5 years out of school, I think, at this point. I don't know why I looked at you as if you'd have any. I asked that in a way that you'd be like, yes, you are. That is correct.
I guess that would make sense since we didn't overlap.
Yeah.
So
what, you were what?
Group
what?
I was group
38. Okay. Yeah, I was 43, so that would make sense. When I was in school, I started to realize that when I was anxious or frustrated, I would drink alcohol because I was trying to like relax out of it. Mm-hmm. And then when I got out of school, I would have a glass of wine and that anxiety of school would like course through me. And I took 4 years off of drinking, which was the length of school. I'm not a huge drinker, but I like to drink, and I just didn't like that it was, I could feel that it was affecting my joy, my day-to-day joy. And so
it was because of
the negative association. So then I stopped. And now if I have a drink, I can just enjoy it as this social thing that I'm doing, or this like relaxing thing that I'm doing. And I don't have that anxiety. So that was something I learned that I really fought really hard with myself to like
4 years, a long time,
get over the 4 years of this. I mean, you know, that school's so hard.
Yeah.
It takes sort of the length of the relationship to get over the relationship. I've also learned that I'm, you know, with things like auditioning, I have a, sometimes have a hard time with it. And I found such joy and creative fulfillment in making self tapes, mm-hmm. and making them feel like I'm shooting a scene or like really getting into it. So I've now made a concerted effort to always request if I can do that, as opposed to going into the room when it's an initial pre-screen.
Right.
Because I feel like I can, you know, the odds of things working out the way you want them to are so like up in the air anyway. I might as well get something that's such that I get such joy out of.
I love that you use the word joy, because often it can, even if it you do like it better than going in the room, can still be like a stressful, oh my God, I have to get this done in this amount of time.
Well, because I'm now trying to think of it more and more like how do I make it feel like a film that I'm shooting? How do I make it feel like a scene that I'm filming? Like if we were doing this podcast as an audition, setting it up like this, mm-hmm. which is like two mics on books, like it just the whole setting, just so you feel like it's happening.
Instead of just the blank wall.
Instead of a blank wall. You. And, you know, there's something about that, that even if nothing comes from it, I just think often nothing comes from an audition. That's just the nature of auditioning. And so at least you don't have to leave feeling upset.
Right. Do you have any artistic mentors that have been important to you?
Yeah. Reed Burney.
Yeah.
He has been a tremendous mentor to me.
And I know he was in the web series you made. When did you
That's first when I sort of together? Got to know him the most. I knew about him, you know, just socially and very peripherally, but then I got to know him during that, and then I did a play.
So amazing.
He's the best, because he also is just a, he's gone through some really hard times. Mm-hmm. And his perspective and insight into that is remarkable. And because he's raised a family and has children, he has this incredible paternal quality that is married in there with this struggle with the 30 years of it being a very difficult career. He's just a great person to talk to. So like if I'm having struggles, I'll text him or call him, or we'll go out to eat or something. But when I did a play called Gloria at the Vineyard Theater, and I asked him to come to my opening, and we weren't that close yet, but I just wanted him to see it and be I liked him. And then from that day on, our friendship just sort of took a turn where we like started to hang out pretty regularly and communicate and be friends. And so he's a big mentor. I don't know. I haven't actually had a lot of mentors. It was something I wanted.
I was just curious. What are you most excited about right now, as far as projects or things you're hoping to work on?
I'm starting a workshop next week with a play that I really like, and I really like the playwright, and it's going to be a lot of fun, and it's a 2-week-long thing, and I'm hoping that that goes really well, because I really respond to the material, but you just never know what, you know, it's a new thing. I don't know what's going to happen. So that is pretty cool. And then at the end of May, a play I did at Williamstown 2 years ago almost is finally coming to the city. And like, you know, half the cast is able to still do it. So it's going to be really fun to get back in the room with, you know.
Yeah, 2 years. Jeez.
It's a pretty long time. It was because they programmed it upon seeing it at Williamstown, but the math of like, it was like the top of the season and this program at the end of this next season. So that's actually like a full 2 years, but it's going to be fun to get back into that because it's such a crazy play and super funny and wonderful. And then I wrote a play that is going to have, be a part of the Pride Plays Festival, which is happening at the Rattlestick. Nice. And so this will be read on, I think, June 24th. And
is that just, like, a week long.
It's like a five days of 10 to 14 readings.
Okay.
But they're all...
I want to find a way to see something.
Oh, please. Well, come to mine. they're all like...
Not yours.
Yeah. They're all queer, LGBTQI identifying artists.
That's awesome.
Who all of them as writers, and then the content as well. And so like a lot of the people, like a lot of the directors are, a lot of the actors will be, and it's just sort of putting everyone forward who are a part of these experiences at different, you know, stages of the decades as LGBT theater has like grown over the past, you know, post Stonewall. It's in honor of the anniversary of the 50th year of Stonewall.
Right.
50th anniversary of Stonewall. 50th year? 50th anniversary? It's weird to call it an anniversary.
Well, that's exciting.
Yeah, so I'm excited about that because this will be the first time this play is read out loud.
At all?
Well, I mean, around my apartment, but in a public way.
Yeah.
And it's a play I wrote about my... what it feels like to be an openly gay actor in this business. And how it still is basically like a scarlet letter that you are battling. And so the play looks at a revival of a play that's happening on Broadway and the casting process of it. And it's two people who play all the different characters.
How do you handle those situations as an actor?
What do you mean?
Or like some of the things that you've run into that are... most frustrating.
They're hard. I mean, there's no way to handle it. It's hard for people who don't know what it feels like to feel what it feels like when someone clocks your sexuality and you can feel the like helium bubble sink in a room. And my play is sort of trying to pinpoint why that happens. Is it about sex appeal? Is it about gay men not being considered sexual beings or sexy in the way that straight men are, like the way that the world reveres straight men and look to them for approval? Whatever the math of it is, it causes, if someone knows your sexuality, it causes most people to stop being interested. And I don't know why, and I'm trying to figure that out with this play. But it, you know, in the room, like in my real life, practically speaking, there's nothing I can do. Particularly as like, it's wonderful that there's so much focus on LGBT characters and queer characters in film and television and theater. But the more popular it gets, the less people are interested in queer and gay people playing those parts.
Right.
And I don't think that they should be only playing that, but that's all we were allowed to play, and now that's not happening. So there's actually less and less and less, because it's not like we're trading. There's not a trade system. It's just now the straight culture. There's not a stigma. And these parts are so good, and they're all like willing to like go down that road for 3 months, and pushes the people out of the way that we're only allowed to do that.
When you are in that dark place, are there any like concrete things that you reach for again and again to help you get out of it? Like books that you reread or music you listen to or things like that?
My dog, I go on long walks with her. Through the park, I immediately, if I'm feeling dark, I reach out to a friend and try to get them to hang out. I don't say, I'm in a dark place, help me out of it. I'll be like, what are you doing? Let's go
get me out of my apartment.
Yeah, let's go walk around. It's walking, being physical for me is a huge thing. Making sure I get enough sleep, taking a nap. Because often, like, darkness for me or depression is related to lack of sleep and my system being off in that way. Sometimes I'll make lists.
I'm a huge fan.
Just like looking at something on a, just looking at it and being like, yeah. Oh yeah, you're right. What am I freaking out over? Or, you know, joining a, like actively doing something to change it. Either joining a, if I'm feeling frustrated, say about auditioning, I'll join an audition class. Or if I'm feeling lonely, I'll reach out to somebody. Or if I'm feeling upset, I will tell Michael about it. I think the best for me is to activate it.
Yeah.
In some way.
Get it out.
Like reading a book is hard for me when I'm in a dark place because I can't pay attention. I can't be isolated when I'm that way.
Right. And then the final question is, have you seen anything lately of any art form that you want to recommend?
I saw a really fabulous production of Tartuffe at Interlaken this last week, and it was just so good.
How fun.
Partly because the director, who comes from the same skill set as Moni, who was our movement teacher at Juilliard, her play was presented in the style of like a Moni show, so it was very like heightened stylistic physical, sharp, angular performances, and it was, you know, it was like 20 people in the cast. It was just fabulous to watch, and that I just was shocked that that's what they're doing at this school. So that was really great. What the Constitution Means to Me, which we talked about earlier.
Yeah, so good. It's
so good and such an important piece of material right now to be like spoken about. So if you can't see it, get your hands on the play and read it. I really like The Act on Hulu.
I don't know about this.
I don't know if I want to tell you about it. You just need to watch it. It's like this incredible true story about a mother who thought her daughter was ill. It's a true story. And raised her daughter as if she was ill.
Oh, I have heard about this.
It's like
this.
An 8-part miniseries, and it's just bananas. Okay.
Yes, I have bananas. Heard about this. And it's true.
It's true. And there's a documentary
about
the true thing, and then there's also just like Googling about the true.
Oh my gosh. We just saw recently, I'm going to get the title wrong. We saw the Mad Ones show.
Oh, uh-huh. It was Mrs. Marjorie's Menagerie. Mrs. Mary's Menagerie or something.
I need to do the title right. Mrs. Murray's Menagerie.
Mrs. Murray's Menagerie. Did you like it?
Mrs. Murray's Menagerie. Yeah, we really liked it. Our friend Stephanie Wright Thompson is in that company. And their work is just so interesting and detailed and quiet. I really liked it.
I want to go. I tried to get tickets, but the night that I wanted to go, I couldn't get a ticket to, and now I don't know if I can go. Because I missed their last show, the Mad Ones' last show.
Yeah.
Miles for Mary.
A lot of M's.
Miles for Mary.
Yeah, but I'm so excited for them. And it's a really, now that Ars Nova took over that space, the Barrow Street Theater, it's a really good space for them, for this show.
I'm also obsessed with the whole like Nexium and Allison Mack cult drama that happened this past year. Do you know about this? This guy, Keith Raniere, who is a part of Nexium, and he started this like subcategory of just like women to come study with him. And he was like the guru.
Again, then, I'm going to say, oh, right, this thing.
And now Allison I recognize Mack, what you're who's saying. Who's an actor who I was aware of as an actor.
I've heard about this on a podcast.
Oh my gosh, it's so good. And there's this great podcast called...
it's like a sex cult or something?
It's a sex cult, and they were like... Yeah, they were...
Or like sex slaves or something?
They were having... He was forcing them to have sex with them, God. But like they were willingly doing it because they were, you know, a year or two deep into this...
Brainwashed.
Whatever this is, and they were brainwashed, and most of them are actors, actresses who were looking for a way out of the dark side, and he offered a place for that. And there's this great podcast podcast with CBC, Canadian Broadcasting Company, with a woman, the woman who broke, Laura Edmond, I believe is her name. She broke the story to the New York Times because she was a former member of the cult. And him, the podcast host and her, they ran into each other like almost a year before it broke in the news because she had just left the cult. And so he started interviewing her early on. And so during the podcast, the news breaks. So then you can also, you see like the build up, you see it break, you see how then it's affecting everyone. It's fascinating.
Okay, I need to listen to that.
It's a good podcast. I think it's only like 6 episodes that are like an hour long. So it's not even like terribly.
Oh my goodness.
It's really good.
All right. Ryan, thank you so much.
Thanks.
This was a delight.
This was great.
Thank you for listening to the Compass Podcast. If you find these conversations valuable to your life as an artist and would like to support the ongoing production of The Compass, please consider becoming a patron at patreon.com/thecompasspodcast. Pledges start at as little as $1 a month. You'll get access to bonus content, and anything you can give would be greatly appreciated. Also, if you have a moment, please rate or review in iTunes. Every little bit helps other listeners to find the podcast. I'd like to thank the following people for their generosity. The Compass cover art is by Kim Miller, music by Brandon Spieth, audio assistance from Nick Choksi, and a special thanks to Frankie J. Alvarez. See you next time.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.